begin by speaking about Rabbi Teitz. Rabbi Teitz, like many other people, the last person I spoke about was Rabbi Belkin, Dr. Belkin. These are people who are titans. These are people who are giants. And they are, for the most part, people who contribute a tremendous amount, and then they are forgotten by the next generation, and it's unfair. I feel Sefer Torah Shebehecho Tzarech Mazal. But one thing that I have seen is that it's based upon the popularity of the books that you write. If you write very scholarly books, as Dr. Belkin did, very few people will remember you. If you write no books, as Rabbi Teitz did, so then nobody will remember you. But if you write a lot of popular books, people will remember you through your books. So if you want to be remembered, write books. Now, Rabbi Teitz is a towering figure. I actually knew him, and I actually was very privileged since my sister and my brother-in-law moved to Elizabeth about 38 years ago, 40 years ago. I got to go there and see Rabbi Teitz many, many times and speak to him. I didn't know him well, but if he would see me, he would know my name. Of course, I know his name. And that was the nature of the relationship. I listened to his shiurim. I listened to his, as we'll get to, as a youngster, I listened with my father and my uncle and Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky to the Daf HaShavua. We'll get to in a second. But he was a towering figure. He was a pioneer. He was an architect of communities. He was a person who was international, and he was a person who feared no man. And he had no reason to fear because he was extremely intelligent. He was a person who was a tremendous Talmud Chacham, learning classically, as we're going to see. He had good ideas about where America was going and how to help it to get to a very good place. And he implemented all of those things in his lifetime. So one of his famous phrases is that the Torah speaks the language of tomorrow. The Torah is not a fossilized past document. It's not even in the present, but the Torah speaks the language of tomorrow. Rabbi Mordechai Pinchas Teitz was born July 7th, 1908 in Latvia, and he was born to a rabbinic family on both sides. His mother came from a very important rabbinic family. She came from Rabbi Mordechai Yafo, from the Lavush. And on the other side, his father came from a series of rabbis, 19 successive generations of rabbis. So it was certainly a rabbinic family. And he grew up a regular childhood, which you won't find in the other biographies, but in this biography of Rabbi Teitz, he would also always say, I had a normal childhood, I played ball, I had a goat, and I would play with the goats, and I had sleds, and I had skis, and I had skates, and I played as a child. But of course, childhood in Latvia at that time, and Lita really was until about 4 years old. And then by the time you were 4 years old, you began to study, and he studied. And he was a very, very wonderful student, a very brilliant human being. In 1914, the Germans and the Russians, this is before World War I, the Germans and the Russians began to suspect Jews, that Jews were spies. So if you had Jews in Germany, they were spies for Russia. And if you had Jews in Russia, they were spies for Germany. And it became known to his family, to his father who was a Rav, Binyamin Avraham Teitz, who lived a very long life in America, as again we'll see. And the ones that they would imprison and torture were the rabbis. Because the rabbis, either they themselves were spies or they knew what Jews in the congregation were spies. And they would be imprisoned. And when Rabbi Teitz's father heard that they were arresting rabbis, he escaped in the middle of the night. As it happened, it turned out to be the night before they came to arrest him. So he was very, very lucky. And he moved deep into Russia, which at that today is Ukraine. And he lived in a city called Poltava, Ukraine. Now in Poltava, the reason that he went there is because Rabbi Teitz had an uncle, his father's brother, who was a very different kind of a person than his father. While his father was very reserved and very scholarly and very gentle and very compassionate, his uncle, while he possessed all of those wonderful qualities, of course, but he was a very dynamic leader in his community. And he was a person who was very, very well known in the community. He had a different name than Tice. His name was Rabinowitz because his parents, this was something that was known in Russia, if you wanted to save your children from conscription, conscription in Russia meant that they took you as a very, very young child for 25 years. Either you were dead or you were ruined by the time that they let you out of the army. So the Jews tried to have their children not come into the army. Anyway, he had a different name, but he was the brother. His name is Rabinowitz, even though the family name is Teitz. Now, he was very, very famous because he published two very influential newspapers. One of them, both of them, as it happens, still exist today. One of them is known as Hamodia. It was not in English, it was in Yiddish. And the other one is Hapeles, which is a newspaper that's published in Israel by the Rabbi Shmuel Orbach group. Anyway, but this Rabbi Rabinowitz, Rabbi Teitz's uncle, was a very dynamic figure, and he was very influential. And part of what he was doing was fighting the Haskalah, was fighting a religion that was going through all of Eastern Europe. His uncle was a Torah scholar, but what made him special was he was a secular scholar. He was an autodidact. He taught himself a number of languages, and he taught himself all of the literature. His uncle read all of Russian literature, and he learned English, and he read a lot of English literature, which made him very, very knowledgeable. And he took a liking to Pinchas, who came to his house together with the family who were escaping, and he taught Pinchas about leadership, and he taught him how to be a leader even in the face of adversity, because as you know, if you know the history of Haskalah, it was burning through Eastern Europe, and anybody who stood in its way was knocked down, because that was the zeitgeist among the Jews. But yet his uncle was very, very able to take the adversity and to run with it. And he also, Rabbi Teitz would note later on that he noticed that it was the secular education that his uncle had that allowed him to be very, very effective. He also learned from his uncle that if you know that you're doing the right thing, criticism should not affect you whatsoever. People have different opinions, but if you have come to the conclusion that this is what you need to do and it was a considered opinion, you follow through with it despite what other people will tell you. Now, his uncle would say to him, look, on our paternal side, we come from the Levush, who was a great halachist. And if you know the history of the Levush, he also put up with a tremendous amount of criticism. When he put out the Levush over and he paskened halachos, many people questioned his piskei halacha. And yet, our great-great-grandfather stood up to them. He was the Levush. And the people who were against him are unknown, or relatively unknown. And the Levush is very famous. On the other side of our family, the maternal side of the family, we come from the Marshal. And you know that the Marshal, Rabbi Shlomo Luria, he not only put up with criticism, but he feared no person. When the rest of the world accepted the Shulchan Aruch as the last word on Jewish law, it was the Marshal who said, excuse me, who are these pups? Rabbi Yosef Karo and Rabbi Moshe of Krakow. Who are these people? We should stop Piskei Halacha because they said so? And the Marshal was able to withstand all of the criticism of his day as being a loner. And therefore, he learned from his uncle that the motto of the family always was, think for yourself. Take advice from others, but think for yourself and come to your own conclusion. And that is probably the greatest influence in his life. And Rabbi Teitz would often say, I remember him even saying that, a person should always be an original. Don't be a copy. I see that. That's a pretty good invitation. Okay. I'll get to it later. He was an incredible orator, incredible speaker, great speaker. Now, the Teitzes saw that even though they were in this town in Russia, Ukraine, that the communists were closing in. This is not 1917. The communists are closing all religious institutions. They're closing synagogues. They're closing the yeshivos. And they realized that they had to escape. And they escaped to the Russian-German border to a city called Livenhof. And at that time, when they went to Livenhof, Rav Pinchas Teitz became bar mitzvah. Like all of these things that happened when he was still before bar mitzvah. At his bar mitzvah, He was sent to Panevėžys, not Panevėžys in Bnei Brak, it didn't exist, but Panevėžys in Lithuania, which was one of the major yeshivos. Just to say two words about the yeshivos in Europe at that time. All of them are known, well, we should call them, are Mibet Midrasho Shel Hagra. All of them are part of the continuous, unbroken chain of yeshivos that began with Rab Chaim of Valozhin, the student of the Gra, which is Valozhin, and all of these yeshivas are offshoots of the Valozhin yeshiva. So he went to Panevėžys, and that's where he studied. He stayed there for 2 years, and his rebbes told him, "Du hast uns ibig ishtigen," which means, "We have nothing more to teach you." And they sent him to Slabodka, and they said, "There in Slabodka, you're going to do very, very well." Now, Slabodka, if you've ever been to Russia, Slabodka is about this big. Very, very small. The whole city is very small. What it actually is, it's an offshoot of the city of Kovno, which is still there. And he went there in 1924 when he was 16 years old. Now, what was unique about Slabodka was that aside from their assiduous, meticulous study of Torah, it was said of Slabodka that the Beis Medrash was never without a minion of people learning. There were people who would sign up for the night shift, for the morning shift, for the afternoon shift. It never stopped learning. That was something that they picked up from Valozhin. Valozhin also, it was a yeshiva that never slept. And aside from that, because of the influence of the Mashgiach Ruchani, then a Mashgiach Ruchani was somebody very important, as opposed to today, was a throwaway job. So Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein was the Rosh Yeshiva. And Ranatz Finkel, Rav Nosson Zvi Finkel, was the Mashgiach Ruchani, but he was the personality of the entire yeshiva, and he had a particular kind. These were all Musa yeshivas, where the legacy of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter loomed very, very large, and each one had a different shita, a different approach to the Tenuat HaMusar, for the Musa of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. And here Ranatz Finkel, his shita, his emda, his point of view was Gadlut HaAdam, that a human being is capable of greatness beyond angels. And that is how he groomed the individuals. But one of the things that he taught all of his students was that if you're going to be a Talmud Chacham and you're going to be greater than an angel, you have to be an impressive human being. Aside from your intellect and aside from your piety, you have to be an impressive human being. And therefore, he taught them all to stand. He would always say, you have to stand with your head over your shoulders. Never slump. But even though you're learning all like that, when you walk in the street, your head has to always be above your shoulder. You have to walk straight. You may never have clothes that look like schlumpy clothes. You have to wear elegant clothes, elegantly conservative clothes, and you have to appear that way in the street so that people will say, "Man Malki Rabbanon, who is royalty?" The rabbis, the ones who study Torah. And he taught them that. He taught them to be able to speak articulately. And of course, it was very, very important for them to be able to take the traditions that they had and to transmit them to others. In Slabodka, his best friend and chavrusa was Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, a very famous person. And that was a lifelong friend. They were lifelong friends. I'm going to get to that in my own personal life. I can testify to Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky's relationship with Rabbi Teitz. Now, at that point where he was doing very, very well in Slabodka, his father, who was also a very big Talmud Chacham, says, "You know, Pinchas, I think that what you should do is, just to get a taste of different kinds of rabbis, I think you should go to Dvinsk. And in Dvinsk, you'll speak to my friend, Rabbi Yosef Rosen, the Rugged Shavagoyen. And you'll speak to my other friend, Meir Simcha. So I want you to meet them, and I want you to speak to them and learn." Now, in those days, they had very, very great rabbis throughout Europe. Sometimes in very small cities. Dvinsk was not a big city. In this city, the Rav of Dvinsk was Rabbi Meir Simcha Kohen of Dvinsk. He was a rabbi of Dvinsk. He was a young man, relative to the Rogachov. And he was a relative unknown. As a matter of fact, he had already written a sefer called Meshech Chachma Av HaTorah. But his mentors told him, "Don't let people know about that book. You wrote it when you were 17. It's beautiful. It's fantastic. if you're going to put out a sefer on Chumash, people are going to know you as a magid, not as a talmud chacham. Find some other venue for your scholarship to become public. So he set upon writing the Or Sameach al HaRambam, which is a major work. It used to be included in the Rambams. When the Frankel Rambams came out, they didn't include the Or Sameach, so then they published Or Sameach, so you had to buy them separately. But whatever, it was a major, major commentary on the Rambam, and it was already put out. When he came to the Rav Meir Simcha Cohen, and when he came to the Rogachova, what did you say? What do you think you spoke about? You know, politics? No. Was lernst du? What are you learning? What sugya are you learning? And they would speak on learning with you. And they were very impressed with Rabbi Teitz. Both of them were very impressed with Rabbi Teitz. Interestingly enough, the relationship that Rabbi Teitz had with the Rogachova Goyen was much stronger than the relationship that he had with Rav Meir Simcha Cohen. What I'm saying is, what's strange is, because the Rogachova was not known, he was a wild genius. He was a wild genius. People said he didn't have a photographic memory. He didn't have a photographic memory. He was constantly reading all the books. He can just literally had a photo. They meant to say he had a photogenic memory. Anything that he experienced and anything that he read, he remembered for the rest of his life. He forgot absolutely nothing. The Rogachova said about himself, since the age of 3, there's nothing that I forgot. And he remembers people. This was a known fact. We could do a biography of the Rogachova. That would be a different thing. But it's a known fact that he would meet people that he did not see in 50 years. Not only would he know their names, he'd know their entire family history. And remember the last time that we spoke, this is what we were speaking about, obviously, in learning. So that he was a person who was very, very much known for never forgetting anything. And he took a very sharp liking for Rabbi Teitz. And they remained friends for a very, very long time. As it happens, many years later, when some of the works of the Rogachova survived Hitler's Europe, it was Rabbi Teitz who set up the Tzofnas Paneach, which is the name of a sefer, the Tzofnas Paneach Rabbi Yosef Rosen Institute. And he was instrumental in publishing a number of those volumes. So if you see Tzofnas Paneach anyplace, and even the republishing of it, it was all published by Rabbi Teitz because of his relationship with the Rogachova. Now, Rabbi Teitz came to America together with Rabbi Eliyahu Meir Bloch, who was the Rosh Hashiva of Tells, in 1933, and they actually came to America to raise money for the Tells Yeshiva. That's why they came. And they went from shul to shul and city to city, and they lectured. That's what rabbis used to do. They would go into a shul, they give a shiur, and at that time, in 1933, there were shuls all across the United States, even in areas, Shelby, Mississippi, and Kansas City, places where there aren't shuls anymore, but that's where there were shuls, and then, well, they were decently populated Jewish populations of European Jews. And when these rabbis would come, they'd give a shiur. And people would be able to appreciate the shiur because all of them were learned people. When they came to Boston, Rabbi Soloveitchik was there, and Rabbi Teitz remembered Tanya Soloveitchik's family. And immediately when he came there, Rabbi Soloveitchik knew who they were, and he invited them to his home. And I saw this in Family Redeemed, that when Rabbi Teitz and Rabbi Elimel came to Rabbi Soloveitchik, they were speaking and learning for the entire day until Rebbetzin Tanya had to come to him and say, "You didn't daven Maariv. You're all very firm guys talking and learning, daven and Maariv." So she had to remind them. And as it happens, during this meeting, Rabbi Belkin was also there because he had come from Brown University to speak to the Rav. So all of them were there, all of these tremendous Talmidei Chachamim, and they were sitting there and they were learning. Now, Rabbi Teitz noted that in every city that they went to, he noticed that many of the Jews, not the older European Jews, but many of the younger Jews were totally uneducated. And that when he would give a shiur, they wouldn't have a clue what he was talking about. In one of the shiurim, he gave a shiur about givi delay. Now, I'm sure everybody here knows what givi delay means. And he said, they didn't know what givi delay meant. He said, I had to explain to them, was heis givi delay? Kannst du vorstellen, was das meint? Sind gewusst givi delay? So anyway, he noticed they were... So, What are we going to say? So anyway, so Rabbi Tais noticed that they were, but he also saw that if he ever planned to come to America, which he already on his first trip to America said, I see that the future is in America. He said that if a person does not know English, they cannot possibly be successful to do anything to plant Torah in America. Now, while he was in America, he was also introduced to a woman who was an American-born woman. Her name was Basia, but better known as Bess, Prale. Now, her father was the rabbi in Elizabeth, New Jersey. The very famous Rabbi Prale was a rabbi, and he was introduced to her. And they got married in 1935, and of course, he traveled back with his bride to Europe. And he introduced her to everybody. She came to the Rogachava, and the Rogachava said, Kvaldik Shidduch. To Meir Simcha, everybody gave their blessings, and then they both returned to America. And the very first thing that Rabbi Tait said, I have to do is, I've got to learn English. He only spoke Yiddish. He spoke Yiddish and Russian. Fluent in Russian, fluent in Yiddish, didn't know English. Thank you, he knew. Please and thank you. And he said, if I'm going to be successful here in America, I need to learn English. And what he did was his wife would teach him to read the New York Times. And every single morning he would read the New York Times with his wife. And then she taught him Shakespeare. And he read the full work, complete works of Shakespeare. And then she had a particular liking for Milton. So then he read Milton. And that is how he got his grounding in English. Again, he was a very, very brilliant person. But by and by, he knew all the editorials of the New York Times. And he also knew all the news of the world, which of course all the Gedolim were always interested in. Don't think otherwise. And he also learned Shakespeare and Milton. And soon afterwards, their first child was born, and he shall live and be well, Rabbi Elazar Meir Tait. He is still the official rabbi of the city of Elizabeth, and by the way, a very, very brilliant mathematician who taught in Rutgers for many, many years, math for many years. I think he's retired. Is he retired?
He's in Israel.
Yeah, okay. So, but he taught in Rutgers. Integral calculus. He taught the higher math courses. Very, very brilliant person. Now, Rabbi Tait's was now in the shul of Rabbi Prale, and he began to become the rabbi of that shul. He married his daughter, and he began to. And it was a very small shul at the time. But at the very same time, to supplement his income, he became the chief mashgiach of a number of slaughterhouses. Now, there used to be, now there are no slaughterhouses in the Northeast, but there used to be a number of slaughterhouses. There used to be 1,000 butchers in New York, New Jersey. Now there's just maybe 50 or 60. Anyway, but he became the chief mashgiach of the slaughterhouse just to make a few extra dollars. But then he became, as we'll get to later, he became very much acquainted with the kashrus bills or non-kashrus business in the Northeast. But whatever it was, he told his wife, I have decided that I'm going to spend the rest of my life building a kahila, and that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to transplant what I know that worked in Europe. And just like we had kahilos in Europe, I'm going to build a kahila, and it's going to be right here in Elizabeth, New Jersey. And that's what I'm going to do. And he says, I'm going to make a complete community. It's going to have everything that a community needs. Now, he knew that before he can build a kahila in Elizabeth, now Elizabeth is a port city. And many Jews congregated there because that's where you can make a business. And there were a number of small shuls, but there were very few Jews. And at that time, Jews, the next generation, had already begun to slowly assimilate and to defect from Judaism. So Rabbi Tait's knew that in order to build the kahila, he needed to import a number of religious European Jews who wanted to leave. They wanted to leave Europe. It was not so easy to leave Europe at that time. And what he did was, he sponsored many members of his family and many other European Jews to come to the USA and, of course, to move into Elizabeth. Now, the very first order of business was to build a mikveh. And he said, that's the first thing you do is build a mikvah. And he went to his board. Every shul, even in the 30s, had a board. And he told the board, I need to build a mikvah. They said, what? What are you, nuts? A mikvah? For whom? Who's going to use it? They can go to Newark. Not that far from Elizabeth. Let them go to the city. There's a mikvah. There's a mikvah, too, in New York. Well, what are you building? We're not doing it. He said, okay. The very next board meeting, he comes in and he says, oh, by the way, I want to tender my resignation. I no longer want to be the rabbi in here in Elizabeth because I can't live in a city without a mikvah. And of course, the congregation met in emergency session and they said, the rabbi is going to resign without a mikvah. We can't have him resign. We like him. I should point out, he was very tall. He was very thin. He was very nice looking. And most rabbis were not tall. Most rabbis were not thin. And most rabbis were not nice looking. And he was. And that was a saving grace. They didn't want to let go of him. Because we're going to know the rabbi looks that good. And they said yes. They said yes. The very next thing that he did was, after he built the mikvah, he said, this whole town is treif. There's no treif. And do you know where the Avi Avos, do you know where all of it's coming from? It's coming from the YMHA. The YMHA is sponsoring Chil Shabbos and treif food. That can't be. And he went to the director of the Y, said, we have to have kosher food with Jews. And the director of the Y wrote in the next edition of the Jewish newspaper of New Jersey, he said, we have this rabbi, this fossilized rabbi who came from Europe, and he's talking about kashrus. Everybody knows that in the 20th century, the hygiene is so excellent, there's no longer any reason to have kosher. And therefore, I refuse to have kosher in the Y. This rabbi is living in the past. But Rabbi Teitz insisted, and he pressured the Y. And let me also point out that there were people that are known, I'll mention them only once, known as the builders. And these were people who were European Jews who loved Rabbi Teitz and who became exceedingly successful business-wise. And when the Y gets pressure from the, quote-unquote, the builders, they're going to do what Rabbi Teitz said. And the idea was, Rabbi Teitz said, I'm not pressuring you to do anything. All I'm saying is that the Y should be able to accommodate all the Jews in Elizabeth. And in order to accommodate all the Jews in Elizabeth, you have to have kosher food. And they became kosher. Then Rabbi Teitz began to introduce other very strange practices. In the fall, in the back of the house that he lived in, there was a beautiful, beautiful group of lilac bushes. You know, lilac's very fragrant, very beautiful. And what they did is they cut them all down, very demonstrative, right along the street. And they put up a sukkah. Nobody had seen a sukkah in front of everybody. And he did that. And then other people began to copy it. Rabbi Teitz also brought a lulav and esrog. Up until that point, there was one lulav and esrog in the entire town. Everybody used the same one. Now the rabbi had his own. And other people wanted to have it as well. The very next order of business, says Rabbi Teitz, is we have to teach Torah to our youth. So in September 1935, Rabbi Teitz established an afternoon Talmud Torah because everybody went to public school. But in the afternoon, they came home, 3 o'clock, whatever it was. And he established this Talmud Torah. And the idea was before that, there was no centralized teaching of Torah. People had tutors, and they had private tutors. It wasn't expensive. It was $1 a week. But he saw this boy wasn't learning anything, and this boy was learning this and that. So he wanted to centralize the study of Torah. So he said, we're going to do it. I'm going to do it in my shul. I'll get my teachers. Of course, there was tremendous opposition by the private tutors, so he was putting them out of a job. But he said, you're not doing the job. If you're good, you can come work for me. And he said he began this Talmud Torah, and he centralized Torah education in Elizabeth. And Rabbi Teitz himself taught Gemara. There were only 4 boys in all of Elizabeth who wanted to come to his class in Gemara, and he taught Gemara. And it turns out that Gemara was never taught in any Talmud Torah, any place in all of the United States. That was the very first time that Gemara was ever taught in the Talmud Torah, albeit to only 4 boys. And after a few years, he was wildly successful. and he had a very large Talmud Torah of over 100 children. And then he said, if we're that successful for Talmud Torah, what we should actually now do is, because there are going to be more children born, we need to build a yeshiva day school. And here he got probably, from what I've seen from his biographies, the most pushback that he got was in building a yeshiva. The bitterest fight that he had, the most uphill battle, was in to build a yeshiva. All of the people in his congregation argued against it. And they said, our children go to public school, and the public school provides an excellent education. And it's for free. So why are you going to bother with this day school? We have no place to put it. We're going to get the teachers that are going to equal the teachers of the public schools. But Rabbi Teitz was adamant. He said, we have to have a yeshiva. They said, but one second, we're greener, which is a term for people who were European Jews who felt that they were not going to be accepted in American society because they were European. This is an issue that many Jews have, even to this day, even if they're not European. And they said, if our children go to public school, at least they'll be able to integrate with American society. They'll learn about America. They'll learn about baseball, and about football, and about basketball, about all of the things that are important in life. And so we can't take them out of the yeshiva. It's not good for our children, out of the public school. It's not good for the children. We don't want to marginalize them. We want them to be Americans. And Rabbi Teitz was still adamant. And he said, we need a yeshiva. And then they said, well, one second. They're already learning Torah for 4 hours a week. 4 hours a week is more than enough of Jewish education. And in the yeshiva, you want to teach them a lot more. And Rabbi Teitz continued to argue. And he says, look at the assimilation. Look at the defection of people's children from Torah life. The only way that we're going to stem the tide is by building a yeshiva day school. And what we're going to do is we're going to offer a superior secular education so that the people who have the children in the public school will want to come to our yeshiva day school just for the secular education. And the bonus will be that we're going to teach them Torah as well. And in 1940, Rabbi Teitz announced the opening of a yeshiva day school in Elizabeth, New Jersey. Now, in the beginning, it was not a very successful school. He had 14 children registered for the kindergarten, and he had only 5 children for the first grade, and he had 2 children for the second grade. One of them was Eliezer Meir, his son, and the other one was the Chazan's son, Herschel Ziegelman. Those were the only 2 kids in the second grade. But he said, Kol haschalos kashos. All beginnings are difficult. You'll see Hashem will bless our work. It's going to be a wonderful yeshiva. And he named the yeshiva Yavne. And he said when there was the destruction of the second temple, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai took the Sanhedrin and he went to Yavne, and it was famous for Yavne v'chachomeha, and that is what we're going to do. We are going to make a school which is going to be the equal of Yavne. Now the tuition was very high. It was $100 a year for tuition. But there were scholarships. There were scholarships. But that was the tuition, $100 a year. And then Rabbi Teitz didn't sit on his hands. Rabbi Teitz worked vigorously. He went to all the neighboring communities, wherever there were Jews, and he went to the shul, and he spoke, and he said, you've got to send your children to yeshiva. If you want them to be Shomer Shabbos, if you want them to be Bar Mitzvah, then you've got to send them to yeshiva. And slowly, the school grew. And eventually, in 1951, they built a very new building on Elmora Avenue, and the Talmud Torah and the yeshiva were both operated out of this same building. Now, Rabbi Teitz had another project. As you can see, he was indefatigable. He went from one project to the next to build a kehillah. And that everything a kehillah would need, he was going to build. And the very next thing he says, look, we've got Torah institutions, but we need a new shul. And the new shul should integrate itself with our Torah institutions. Let's build a new shul near the yeshiva and the Talmud Torah. That's what we need to do. And in that way, we'll consolidate all the communal institutions, and we'll all know that this is where you go to Davin, and this is where you go to study Torah. And by now, there were 150 students in Yavne, and there were 300 students in the Talmud Torah. And they built the shul, and all three were there together, and they decided to call it the Jewish Educational Center, better known as JEC. And that is what is still called until this very day, the JEC. Now, at this time, we are dealing in the late 40s, and Rabbi and Mrs. Teitz, now, I'm going to say one word. The Rebbetzin Teitz was a quiet woman on the outside, but an exceedingly dynamic woman on the inside, and one would have to have a separate lecture just for her major accomplishments in life. She was not only her husband's partner, but she was a person in her own right to accomplish a tremendous amount. So, well, I'm not speaking about her this morning, but I want this to be known, that she was his partner in everything that he did, and she advised him in everything that he did, and in her own right, she was a woman of tremendous accomplishment. But now, in the late 40s, there was a new task at hand, which was to take care of the people who survived the Holocaust. They needed to leave refugee camps, they needed to leave the displacement camps, and they needed to leave the cities that they all congregated in as refugees. And they took it upon themselves to join the Vat Hatzalah. It was a large group called the Vat Hatzalah, which was the way to save all of the refugees. But he and his wife decided that they need to open the doors of Elizabeth, New Jersey, to as many refugees as were possible. And Rabbi Teitz himself, with his wife, went to Europe. And they went to Paris, because in Paris there were many, many young people. And he helped to find refugees and link them up with families that were their families here in America. And he also set out to find great rabbis and their children and see if he can save them as well and help them emigrate to America. And he did this in great numbers. And he was very much involved in the Vat Hatzalah. Again, there were many people involved, but Elizabeth, New Jersey had a major involvement in this Vat Hatzalah. After November 28, 1947, when the UN voted to establish the State of Israel, Rabbi Teitz became a very strong Zionist, very much involved in promoting that the United States should recognize Israel as a state as well. And he became a very strong advocate. And he went around from place to place and from senator to senator and from congressman to congressman to try to lobby that they should be very helpful and they should be very positive about the State of Israel. And as a matter of fact, Rabbi Teitz was involved in some other kinds of dealings. Now, what happened in 1948 when the Arabs attacked, many yeshiva boys, especially in Torah Vadas, as it happens, which was in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, what they would do is they would go to, the world was a different place then, they would go to sporting goods stores, they would go to Sears, and they would buy as many pistols and as many rifles and as much ammunition as they possibly could. And their intention was to either go to Israel with this, smuggle them to Israel, or to somehow send them in the Zim lines and smuggle them to Israel in that way. But there were many, many, many guns. And they needed a place to hide those guns. And Rabbi Teitz, he's not alive anymore, I can say it. Rabbi Teitz assisted them in hiding those guns. As a matter of fact, when many of those yeshiva boys were looking for a place to practice where to shoot, they went to an area, open area, near Newark Airport, at that time was very, very open, not realizing that right next to where they were was the pistol range of the Newark Police Department. And they were arrested for shooting. And Rabbi Teitz came to bail them out. He bailed them out on his good name. He bailed them out. So he was very, very much involved with Israel and his lifelong. They didn't say the Tefillah al-Shlom Adina, did they? They didn't. Because he was still an Agudinik. He was still an Agudinik. In other words, he was able to keep religion and nationalism separate. We love Israel, we're Zionists, we're nationalists, but it's halacha. I'll follow the halacha. Which is another quality we'll get to soon, that not many people can do. And Rabbi Teitz was very much involved with Israel. He also felt that what are children going to do in the summer? We have them in the day school all year, and there were girls in our Talmud Torah all year, and in the summer, it's the naked city. And he started a camp called Camp North Star, very, very far away from New York and New Jersey. And in that way, he was able to give them the supplemental religion during the summer as well. One of the monumental, the same year that he started Camp North Star in 1953, one of the monumental accomplishments of Rabbi Teitz was the following. We have new technology. God does not allow new technology to take place if it doesn't have some kind of a Torah value. There's radio. Why can't we use radio to disseminate Torah to people who are not coming, will come to them? What do all Jews listen to? They listen to the radio. And what station do Jews listen to? Not WINS, it's all in English. They listen to the Yiddish radio station. There was only one Yiddish news station, which was WEVD. So Rabbi Teitz went to the WEVD directors and said, I would like to buy some time on your radio station. For what? I want to teach Gemara on the radio. And when do you want it? Not a busy time. Saturday night. Saturday night, people are out. They're not listening to the radio. I want to buy the time. So they sold him the time. And he began something which is known as Daf HaShavua. And he began it. The first one was January 19th, 1953. Now, here was his theory. Many, many European Jews live in New York, New Jersey, Connecticut. And the lapsed Jews, the European Jews, because of the strong pressure to work on Shabbos, they now work on Shabbos. And they have lapsed in terms of their observance, but they're European Jews. Many of them learned in Cheder as children. They learned Gemara as children. What I'm going to do is, they're going to hear the tones. They're going to hear Abaye and Rava on the radio, on their station. And it's going to reawaken within them all of the warmth and all of the beauty of Judaism that they absorbed and that they imbibed when they were children. It'll bring back the warm nostalgia of what they were in the Cheder. That was part of his theory. It's going to reawaken them. And he had this Daf HaShavua. And it was from 1953 until 1988. Now, in the 1950s, all foreign language stations were monitored by the United States. Because at that time, we were very much afraid of communism, especially Jews and Yiddish and communism. And they monitored WEVD, especially Rabbi Teitz. And the United States government estimated that in 1962, there were over 200,000 people listening to Daf HaShavua. Now, I remember as a kid, it was a different world than when I was young. I don't realize how old I am until I think about these things, so I have to explain them, because nobody's understanding that. Now, what people used to do on Saturday night, at least where I lived, is you go someplace for Malava Malka. So, we always went to my aunt for Malava Malka. She was married to a European Jew, Rav Avram Leib Berkovich, who was a European Yid, a real European Yid. His father was a famous Rav, the Lachva Rav. He escaped Nazi Germany together with Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky and a few other people, and they came to Toronto, and from there they came to New York, etc. So every other Saturday night, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky would come to my aunt from Malava Malka. I came because that's where they took us. Children didn't have their own thing. You went where your parents took you. A novel idea. And we would sit at the table. And I remember, 8 o'clock, everything stopped. Ooh, ooh, Rapilchus. So Yaakov was a friend of his, and my uncle knew him very, very well, and everything stopped. And then you listen to Daf HaShavua. Altsige gut vochzeich. Das Rapilchus teitz mit the Daf HaShavua. That's how it always began. Lama umfangen. Steht in die Gemara. Der heilige Gemara sagt. That's how it was. And that is what he did for all of those years. And it was a very, very popular show. Any mesechta he was learning, this is just a true story. Any mesechta he was learning, every copy of that mesechta were gone from every bookstore in New York and New Jersey. So much so that Rabbi Teitz had to make an announcement, whoever needs, let's say, Maseches Sukkah, write me a postcard, and I will have it shipped. I'll have it shipped. He went into the printing business. Every time he started a Masech, he had to print hundreds of copies of the Masech to send out. So in the area of Torah, even outside of New Jersey, he captured that audience. Now in the area of Kashrus, just tell me if it's too late. I'll stop. Is it too late? Daniel, I'm asking you something.
I have to leave for me, but I don't want to speak.
No, if people are leaving, I don't want to keep people. Then people may have to leave and they say, oh, I don't want to leave right in his face. I don't care, leave. But just tell me, I will stop. Rabbi Tice won't care. Okay. Now,
can you still listen to those? Are they like anywhere in the web that you can listen to those old ones?
You're the computer person. You're the computer person. You can find out. It's all archived.
Is it in Yiddish or
in the it's in Yiddish, but as it happened, at a point in time, I wasn't going to talk about it, his son Elozo Meir started in English.
Oh, okay.
So there's English, and there also, he translated his father's shiurim.
So if you want to learn Yiddish, he started...
They started. When people stopped speaking Yiddish, like you pagans, he had to be translated into English. Okay, but anyway, another area where Rabbi Teitz was very powerful was in the area of Kashrus. It turns out, it's unfair to say, but it turns out that in many kosher slaughterhouses, in order for profit motive, they would sell treif meat. The same thing was true about chickens. In order, again, for the profit motive, they would do things to the chickens, even if they were kosher, to make them unkosher, like boiling the chickens in hot water to take the feathers out, which is cooking the chicken in the blood, so it becomes treif. And he was a one-man gang against all of them. His life was in danger many, many times. He went against the unions. And he was a person who created a standard for kashrus. He was very much against this idea of glatt kosher. And he used to say, I lived in Europe also. There was no glatt kosher in Europe. Man de Ungar, she de gewen, glatt kosher. By us, we never had glatt kosher. So why are we going to have it over here? Because the Hasidim wanted, the Hungarians wanted. We're not Hungarians, we're not Hasidim. And he was adamant. And he says, my kosher is as kosher as their kosher, but I'm not going to call it glatt kosher. And until his... Now, I actually studied under Rabbi Teitz. I had a ksav for shechita, and I went to his slaughterhouse in Elizabeth to learn how to do a bedikas panim. Now, he was an expert. He was an expert in bedikas panim. He'd put his hand in, and he would say, okay, I hear the sircha here, I pull out the liver, there's something wrong with the liver, just by feel. He was really quite an expert, and he maintained the standard. He was the standard, and I believe he was the last slaughterhouse open in the Northeast, and only closed because the people who owned it went out of business. Like, kosher only shechted one day a week. The rest of it was treif. There just wasn't enough meat. Now, in 1958, Congress passed the Federal Humane Slaughter Act, which in fact was going to be an anti-shechita bill. They framed it in a way that even though kosher slaughter is inhumane, but because of the Jews that live here, we're going to allow them, we're going to exempt them from this bill. And Rabbi Teitz and a number of other rabbis felt that was a terrible thing. To say that shechita is inhumane, but because they're Jews, he understood from what happened in Germany in 1933, in Bavaria in 1932, that these were all anti-Semitic methods of barring shechita. He knew what was coming next. Right? In 1933, before they slaughtered 20 million people, the Nazis also were very humane to animals. As the prophet says, Zovchei Adam Agolim Yishaku. But anyway, Rabbi Teitz testified in a Senate committee, and he explained how kosher shechita is. He brought testimonies of many professors who he brought to his slaughterhouse, who saw that even in the hoisting and the shackling, there was no duress to the animals, and he was able to win the day, and they changed the language of the bill, not saying that they exempt Jews, but that Jewish shechita is humane. When he went up against the kosher poultry business, he found that they were selling non-kosher chickens, and they were selling them as kosher. So he devised the notion of a plumber, of attaching a metal, which was very difficult to remove without ripping out the skin, so that anybody would know if the chicken was kosher or not. And he was very much involved in what turned out to be a New York law of kosher law enforcement, which a number of years ago was called unconstitutional, because the conservative movement wasn't covered by it. So they decided, if we can't be part of it, this is public facts. Let nobody have kosher enforcement, and the New York, New Jersey laws would. But he was the one who started that. In 1955, He built a yeshiva high school, which was an unheard of thing to do. An elementary school was enough, and that's all you really needed. You already bar mitzvah. In 1963, he built a high school for girls called Bruria, and the name of the school indicates what he assumed. He assumed that every Jewish woman was capable of study. And what's interesting is just another fact, that when they had the 10th anniversary of the Daf HaShavua, and they had a very special celebration in a hotel in New York, 50% of the people who came were women, and they came with their Gemaras. And it turned out that they came to him and they said, "We have been learning Daf HaShavua with you for all of these 10 years." So everybody says that Rabbi Soloveitchik was the first person to teach women Gemara. In fact, it was Rabbi Teitz. And Rabbi Teitz expected, and if anybody who went to Bruria, I know my nieces went to Bruria, and it was an excellent school. Mrs. Newman, the most incredible, incredible principal. Rough, tough, strict, but an incredible, incredible principal. He also was very much involved in national politics, Jewish national politics, and he was the president of the Agudas Rabban of America, which doesn't really exist anymore. Then they had many, many powerful real rabbis, and he was the head of that group. He also started something, before Hillel, which were known as the Yavne clubs in mostly Ivy League schools. And he started the Yavne club, where there would be rabbis who would come to teach Torah to children, the boys and girls who were in these colleges. He also started the first one, the Kosher Dining Club at Princeton. That was done by Rabbi Teitz. He koshered the kitchen. He had the specifications. All of that was done by him. Another area where he was very, very special was in the area of Soviet Jewry. Now, many people take a lot of credit. Rabbi Teitz was never a person to take credit. He just did things. Everybody spoke about what they did, and he just did things without speaking about it. And he was the very first rabbi to travel. It was very difficult to even get a visa to the Soviet Union. And he was very smart. They would not grant him a visa because he was from Russia. But his wife, Mrs. Prale, Basia Prale, was born in America. So what he did was he had her get the visa first, and they allowed family members to travel with people with visas, so he traveled on her visa, which was very, very smart. And when they came to... The first trip was on July 25th, 1965, and they were told from the very outset that the moment that they would land in Moscow, they would have a guide, who, in quotations, who was a KGB agent, but they were told, everything you say and everything you do is monitored by the government, and be very, very careful, because we're going to know everything you're doing. So much so that when they got to their hotel, There was a maid who was very helpful in them unpacking, because they came with a lot of stuff, and making the beds properly, and she handed her a small bottle of perfume. 5 minutes later, the maid came back, and she said, "They saw you do that, and they said, I can't keep anything from you, I had to give it back." So anything that they were doing was monitored, but he knew the danger, and he went to as many synagogues as he could. There weren't many. And he met as many Jews as he possibly could. And he tried to tell them, you have brothers and sisters in America who are thinking of you. And that for them was something which was major. He realized that they had no religious equipment at all. Nothing. They didn't have Jewish calendars. They didn't know when Rosh Chodesh was. They didn't know when the Jewish holidays were. They had absolutely nothing. And when he returned after that trip, he told his wife, what we need to do is, we have to make sure that the Soviet Union and the Jewry there are the number one priority of all American Jews. And that's what we're going to do. And he began to reach out to other Jewish organizations, secular, every kind. And he was stonewalled wherever he came. And they said, it's impossible. There's the Iron Curtain. You can't break through it. It's a pipe dream. The fact that you went to Russia is absolutely of no meaning. We're not going to help you. But he continued to work. And over the next 15 years, the Titus made 20 trips to the Soviet Union. And in that time, they brought hundreds of talesim, hundreds of pairs of tefillin. All of this money was raised in Elizabeth. Hundreds of pairs of tefillin and mezuzos. And he created something which is called the Mifal Hatzolat Yahadus Russia. And the second president of that group was Dr. Bernard Schanzer, Bruce's father. Very, very much involved in Soviet Jewry. And then Rabbi Teitz got funding to print Jewish calendars and Jewish almanacs, and he translated a number of fundamental books on Judaism into Russian, including Rabbi Soloveitcher's Lonely Man of Faith, and he had them sent there, and he brought, the next trip, he brought letters, hundreds of letters from college students all over the United States to show that these, that there's solidarity with them, etc., etc., etc. I guess we're just going to end and say that there's so much more that one can say about Rabbi Teitz. I just want to say just a final paragraph. He died in December 26, 1995, so his yahrzeit is coming up, Dalet Teves, Tavshin Nun Vav. Just some of his phrases that he used. I started by saying he said the Torah speaks the language of tomorrow, and he always planned for that future, and everything he did was geared toward the future. He was very steadfast in Torah traditions. He said, I never had to violate one halacha. I accomplished so much with so many people, and Baruch Hashem, I never violated one halacha. Not one, ever. I never compromised. He was a pioneer. He was an architect. He was a Talmid Chacham of note, wrote many scholarly articles, and he was a disseminator of Torah. I want to just leave you with one of his famous quotes. He said, learn Torah, love Torah, live Torah with joy. And that was the motto by which he lived his life, and he built so much. He built the Kehillah of Elizabeth. Happy Hanukkah to all of you.